Hello and welcome to Cinepile. From the new releases to the titles that are off the beaten path, join us as we discuss and explore the art of filmmaking. You're listening to Cinepile. Let's start the show. Hey guys, welcome to Cinepile, episode 8. We're the podcast that cares about films. Now, I'm your host, Cooper Carr. I'm with my amazing co-host, Neil Anderson. Kyle is out in Los Angeles right now doing some freelance work. So it's just going to be me and Neil talking about our recommendations. Neil, kick it off.
Okay, so for my recommendation today, it's a great film. And I'm not going to really talk about the film, though. But what I want to say about it, it has to do with our episode.
Okay.
So the film is Oh Brother, Where Art Thou? I'm sure a lot of you people have already seen it. If you haven't, please go check it out. It's a Coen Brothers film, shot by Roger Deakins. George Clooney's a star. It's an excellent film. But what's interesting about it that most people probably don't know is that it is the first film to be completely finished digitally. And that goes for editing, color grading, and finish. So what that means is back in the old days... everything was shot on film. And what you would have to do is you ended up editing reel to reel on film, and you'd assemble essentially some sort of edit list that you'd send it to a finisher and a colorist who would then do a difficult process of
chemical baths, right?
Yeah, essentially. But it was they used something that's called a telecine, and once you got a little bit later, that it would convert film into video, like analog video signal.
Right.
So you could watch it. So it's still on film, and like a light is shooting on the film.
Mm-hmm.
And so you could work and add like more red. I want more red in this scene. I want more green in this scene. And you do that for the entire film, and then you basically backtrack it and color the actual film for print. Well, in the 90s, more digital means started happening where it became cheap enough that you could just completely digitize the film stock in a high quality form, mm-hmm. and you'd use that for finishing. So you'd send that to the editors, they'd edit, and then they'd send that to the colorist who would then color digital means, and then they'd use that digital file to master and print to film.
Yeah, and then wasn't because George Lucas was kind of behind that in a big way, wasn't he? Like the kind of like the digitalization of from film to media. I remember like he used to make these.
It's a good question. I'm not actually sure.
Big Avid booths that I remember he really really pushed out, and was kind of
for
like,
people that don't know what's an Avid booth.
Oh, so an Avid booth would be like a big giant editing suite, like something that would be both a like, I remember, if you look to your left, it'd be this wraparound desk, and it had reel-to-reel for, like, editing, mm-hmm. and then in front of you would be a screen, and so you would just play the reel, and then you would actually physically cut it, but I remember, I think at the time, how you were saying the telecine, in that you would play it back and forth, and it could temporarily record it, or something like that, but I remember somehow he made these big, giant booths and supported Avid in doing it, and they took it at a big loss, but it actually was something that kind of got the spokes going on the industry to actually start becoming a more and more digital world. And a lot of people went against him because everyone was in love with film at the time. But I know in some way George Lucas was in the background pushing forward this big digital revolution that we're experiencing now completely.
We're lucky that we are pretty actually far removed, even though it's not that long ago that this happened.
Mm-hmm.
It's almost like an alien process that
I can imagine. Like,
we read about it to see how people did it back then, when it was only maybe 10 years before we started getting into making films, mm-hmm. but we have never touched anything like that.
Right.
And I think that kind of speaks volumes for how quickly and how effective this digital intermediate, that's what they call it,
mm-hmm.
How powerful it is and how much time saving you can have and cost savings. But more importantly, it's huge for color grading. It opened up the doors for what you could do to footage. Mm-hmm. So in the film that I'm talking about, Oh Brother, Where Art Thou, the reason it has the look it does is because they were able to use it digitally. They were able to color it digitally.
Yeah.
They shot the film in Mississippi in the summertime when it was green and lush outside. But they didn't want it to be green and lush outside. They wanted to have the yellow greens and it's a sepia tone.
Yeah.
And it was Roger Deakins that recommended, hey, we should try doing this digitally because
I didn't know that.
They weren't able to do it. They did tests. They did different, like a bleach bypass. They tried different chemical processes, and they couldn't get the look they wanted.
Yeah.
So the story goes Roger Deakins recommended doing it digitally, and they ended up doing it, and it turned out great.
Roger Deakins is the best. What's really good is have you ever been to Roger Deakins' website?
I have.
It's so terrible, but it's so good.
Well, it's awesome because he talks to people. He answers legitimate questions.
Yeah, like when Kyle talked about that, I thought he would be relatively unresponsive, a month or so in his responses. But some people within the same 2 or 3 days, he's like, oh yeah, blah 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 blah. And I'm just like, that's amazing. That because Roger Deakins is kind of an old guy, and to still be active on forums and stuff like that, and still have that kind of passion and wanting to pass down his information is amazing. But for those who haven't seen Oh Brother Where Art Thou, can you try to describe the look that it gives it? Because it's an amazing movie as far as cinematography, plot, and everything else. But really, the color is the, I think, steals the show.
Well, yeah, they wanted it to make it like a worn photo, like an old photograph. It's a very almost stereotypical sepia kind of tone. But when you attach Roger Deakins to this, it's well done. It's not like when you were using Windows Movie Maker or back when we were young and you just threw, or even, hey, like Photo Booth or something like that and just throw a sepia tone on it. It's not like that.
Well, I remember, you remember Wesley from film school, and he did Good Grief, his short film, and he wanted to do the Oh Brother Where Art Thou thing. And I remember that was such a pain in the ass trying to get all the,
because you
did a color correction to it too. A little bit.
No.
Because you were in the room with me. And you were helping.
Oh, okay. Yes. We were figuring I was kind of your assist. Oh, yeah.
That was so aggravating. I remember I was using SpeedGrade. That failed on me. And so I was stacking secondary color correction layers. So I'd have to get the bright greens. Then I'd have to do another secondary color correction layer. Do the dark greens. Then the mid-tone greens. And then try to turn all of those to the same quality of orange. And I actually got a pretty good look out of it. I was really surprised.
What was that? Class, our advanced film class, where I pretty much for the first time even heard of what color grading was.
Yeah, that was when you were first being born.
And I was, even when we were getting assigned roles, I was like, man, I'd love to do color.
Yeah.
But then when our professor said, oh, that's going to be its own role.
Yeah.
I was like, ah, dang. Well, I have to do editing. Yeah. So.
But then actually, because I remember when SpeedGrade failed on Parked, the short film that you ended up
just doing it in Premiere.
Yeah, we did a Premiere.
Red Cine.
Yeah, and then, I remember then you took it, and then you kind of troubleshot it and everything like that, and then you really started getting to the guts.
Yes, of the computer. That's how I started.
That was your very first thing. Is you were just why is this not working? I remember I was so impressed with you because I just threw up my hands, and I was like, I'm not dealing with this shit. It just is aggravating me. And I'd come back 3 hours later, and then there are you just researching on the internet, how to troubleshoot all this stuff. And I was like, oh, okay. And to anyone who's listening, Neil's actually a, would you call yourself a colorist now, or an entry-level colorist? What would be your kind of, because you've done commercials, you've
I'd call myself a colorist, but professionally I'd call myself a junior colorist. Let's say that.
Okay, junior colorist.
Yeah.
But and I'd also say with Oh Brother Where Art Thou, the color certainly conveys that dreaminess of it, because Oh Brother Where Art Thou, it's supposed to be kind of an allegory to the Odyssey.
Exactly, yeah.
And so it's supposed to have kind of this wonderful, fantastical kind of quality to it, and it just makes it so, I don't know, remarkable and unforgettable. Towards you can close your eyes and you instantly know, Oh Brother Where Art Thou. You see the white and black, criminal clothing that that they're all wearing, all the main characters are wearing, and then that orange sky.
Chain gang.
Yeah, the chain gang. It's the orange sky, the orange everything else, and it makes the
It's the brown greens. There's no tree that's green.
Yeah.
But it doesn't seem fake.
Yeah. Well, and I think that's kinda I don't know what it is about the South. In I don't know, maybe it's northern people or how people look at it, But the South has always had this weird magicalness to it. Mm-hmm. You know, to where you look at the movie Mud, it's all about, I know you haven't seen that, but Matthew McConaughey's character is very superstitious, very supernatural. It's filmed in this very, like, wonderment, kind of in the Beast in the Southern Wild. Mm-hmm, it has okay. this kind of, like, we're in an environment that's foreign and alien, and that's, like, what the South is. It's, like, this unknown, magical place.
Was that
place.
In Louisiana? Or
it was all, yeah, it was in yeah, Louisiana. Okay.
During that phase.
In New Orleans, yeah, before New Orleans completely destroyed their film industry. But that was their governor who really fucked that up.
Story for another time.
Yeah, story for another time for sure. But, yeah, I'd say Oh, Brother, Where Art Thou was one of the top-tier movies that definitely, for sure, recommend for either cinematography, plot.
History. Yeah,
color, for sure. Because I can't imagine, like, back in the day having to come up with chemical, you know, processes to be like, okay, so how are we going to explore the green in this film? Well, we're going to put some benzene and some... I mean, I have no idea what their chemical baths were made up of, but I mean, it well, almost seems I like alchemy say, in a lot of ways.
It was, you know? Exactly.
Yeah, it was like the last
but
bit of magic.
It was, you know, let's make sure we know that it's done by, like, scientists mm-hmm. that worked for, like, Kodak, you know? Like, it's not necessarily that, like, individual colorists were... doing the alchemy.
Right.
They were just more of the art side of yeah. which processes to use, you yeah. know. They didn't necessarily make the process, because a lot of the science behind film was baked into the film itself.
Right.
Which is not the case anymore. Well, we, you know, we can get
with
the
raw codex and everything like that.
Yeah, it's changed, or it's not inside. It's
external no
longer now.
Silver
it's,
and crystals and
yeah,
stuff like that.
Yeah.
Literally, it was baked in with light burning in images. But, yeah, color correction is amazing where it's come along. Do you have any more to say about that?
No, let's go. Let's do yours.
Okay.
Let's do yours.
It's kind of the same time period, actually, the one that you did.
Mm-hmm. Oh, Brother, Where Art Thou was 1930s.
1930s, yeah. And made in 2000. And
it came out in 2001.
Yeah. 2001, I believe. February 2nd, I think I saw on IMDb to get my Rain Man-ness going on. Won the best Grammy. The movie that I'd be recommending is Legends of the Fall. It's a movie that I actually have grown up with. I would say easily have seen, honestly, 15 times.
Wow.
Yeah. Like, it was my... I used to live with a guy named Nick Ferguson, and that was like, if we were bored, we would watch Legends of the Fall, because it was such an excellent, excellent movie. I like movies specifically that are... I wouldn't want to call them minimalistic, but it's a like a true, realized genre films. Mm-hmm. Like, something that doesn't seem too big. Something that actually did make legendary people. You know, if you're going to talk about, like, war, if you're going to talk about moments of people actually overcoming things that make sense, not aliens falling from the sky and things of some such. That's where I really gravitate to. And Legends of the Fall is about this family called the Ludlows. And essentially, they live out in northern Montana. They're cattle ranchers. And they're just completely generic people. Until one day, there's a woman who comes into their lives. And the youngest son, Samuel, comes back with this beautiful woman. Her name's Elizabeth. She's educated. She's smart. She's beautiful. And, you know, all the brothers start turning their gaze to her, but not in a negative kind of way. Like, it's a, like, wow, Samuel's doing this amazing thing. But it's like Samuel wants to impress his girl. And so he does other things. He has to pursue other things, like going to World War I. And so the brothers go, I can't let my youngest brother go to World War I on their own. So Samuel goes to World War I. Tristan, who's played by Brad Pitt, has to go to World War I. And so you see, like, how World War I affects all three of them in different ways and where it takes them in three different journeys. And so it's a very exciting and a very interesting film that it truly does follow an entire family, but has a magical aspect with, like, Native American mythology to it, because they're raised by a man who was a part of the Sioux, and they're like they become men when they're children.
Is this where you got your original fascination with the Sioux?
No, I actually got that in college.
Okay.
When I learned about Native Americans through my history professor, Eunice Pollock, forever indebted to her for that. But it is a fun exploration in the Sioux culture a little bit. But it follows them in such a great way. It's a tragedy for sure, but it's a drama. It's a thriller. It completely I'd say straddles anywhere from about 20 to 30 years in this family's life. And it's just this dynastic, wonderful film that's pieced together. It has Brad Pitt, Anthony Hopkins. I can't remember the other two brothers' names, but they're also excellent actors. Everything's done well. The director is Edward Zwick. They won Best Cinematography for it. I don't know who the director of photography is. Can't think of it off the top of my head, but it's just a go-to, beautiful film that has an amazing score. And
oh, nice.
I don't know. It just has a very good, it just has that great spot in my heart. Because the thing was, is back in my, I'm not sure what it was like for your family, but my family listened to soundtracks when we ate dinner. And
we definitely didn't do that.
Yeah. And there's still like this one song that Samuel sings in the movie, and it's called The Girl in the Wood. And I remember my mom and I, when we were like, I mean, this is horrible, how much of a mama's boy I am. Like, we would dance in the kitchen to, like, this particular soundtrack. Like, my mom would be like, come dance with me in the kitchen. I was, like, 12. So I would go and do that. And so, like, it's so funny because this film, like, to me is so close in so many kind of weird ways, because I listen to it, like, you know, dancing with my mom in the kitchen, everything like that. So it has, like, this very, like, family kind of thing for me. And I think that's why I like it so much, because it's about family sticking together. It's about families coming apart, but mm-hmm. still staying in there and pursuing their own kinds of things and holding each other accountable. But at the same time, when there are schisms, because they are family, they're dramatic and they're understandable at the same time. The movie makes it legitimate. And it's a great story for the heart, for the soul, and just a cerebral experience overall, as far as just getting into the characters' mindsets.
Well, not to mention, like you were saying before, like the large scope.
Yes.
There's nothing sometimes better than a film that has such a large scope and mm-hmm. pulls it off.
Yeah.
And especially, like,
it doesn't get buried underneath itself.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
It's not like Cloud Atlas.
Nah.
But, yeah, so I'd definitely say check out Legends of the Fall. It's, I think, from, like, 1993, but it's excellent. All in film. None of this fancy color digital. Correction digital stuff that we were talking about, but easily, I'd say, in my top 10 movies. It's one of my favorite films. It warms the cockles of my heart. On the Anderson scale, I would put
We haven't brought up the Anderson scale in a while, actually.
Yeah, so let's review. The Anderson scale is what, Neil?
So the Anderson scale is a scale from 0 to 10,
mm-hmm.
but normally when people do a scale, a failing scale, grade on a normal person's scale is usually a 6.
Right.
Like, that's a bad movie.
A high school kind of way of looking at
it. And that just dilutes all the numbers.
Right.
Truly, 5 should be... We need a bell curve scale.
Right.
That's what the world needs. It's a bell curve scale. Well, 5 is perfectly average.
Which
most movies you've seen are 5s.
So, let's say Tree of Life, Transformers 3... and Oh Brother Where Art Thou, where would they land for you?
So I didn't see Transformers 3, but I'll probably give that a 3 or 4.
Smart.
So it's still, see, even Transformers, I'm not saying that's a 1.
Right.
Because you will probably never encounter a 1. Just like you really can't encounter a 10.
Right.
Because that's a perfect score. Like you might have, what is that, what were we saying? You might have like 10 9s.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
In your list. And, like, if you find another movie that you're like, oh, that's a 9, you got to drop one.
Exactly.
You know, it's like, yeah. It's like, if you know someone's 9s,
yeah.
You know this person.
Right. Yeah. You know, yeah.
It's
for
an
sure.
intimate thing. Where it's
yeah.
Like,
that is kind of a funny thing towards, like, when people say, like, certain movies, and you're like, ooh, yeah, I'm not going to talk to you anymore.
Yeah. Like, if someone's like, this movie is an 8, you're like, this is an incredible film.
Yeah.
Incredible.
Yeah, for sure. And like Legends of the Fall, I'd put that at 7.5, 8. I think
that's incredible.
And you've never seen Legends of the Fall, right?
I haven't.
Okay.
That's why I was pretty
now,
quiet.
Granted, I'll give it probably maybe, you would probably think it's a 7, I think. But because it has such an emotional contact to me,
yeah.
And because I've watched it so many times, I've probably fluffed it up to a 7.5, to an 8. But,
well, nostalgia is a good thing.
Yeah, nostalgia is a great spice to life. And then where would something like Tree of Life land for you?
You know, I need to see it again.
Okay.
If just a knee-jerk
yeah.
rating, I'd probably give it a 6.5,
okay.
7, because okay. I really liked it.
Okay, cool.
Oh, Brother Out There would probably be a 7. 7.5.
Yeah, I'd say 7.5.
So it's that's a very good film.
Yeah.
So everyone is...
Yeah.
I take my rating very seriously. We call it the Anderson scale because...
It's an exclusionary scale.
Yes, it is.
And it's meant to be.
Yeah, it's like the Hall of Fame for sports.
Yeah, exactly.
It's not about inducting people. It's about keeping people out.
Yeah, because I've tried to explain this to people, like how we grade films, and they're just like, wait, I don't understand. Like a 5, I'm like, no, 5 is it's the middle. It's the most average film. It's something that you walk out, maybe gives you a little bit of movie fuzz afterwards, but is ultimately forgettable.
Yeah.
And it's like 7, that's something that you would recommend to friends. 8s are just something
even a 6 is mildly recommendable. Yeah, that's
for sure.
Because a 6 is better than most films.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So you got to think of it like that too.
Yeah, something that you can
and you could even be like, this was a 5. It was on the lower side of 5. You know, this was, I'm not going to go to 4.5, but you know, there's other 5s that were better than this film.
Yeah. But and you said Over Brother Where Art Thou, you give that a 7.
I'd probably give that a 7 or 7.5.
Okay, so we got a 7, 7.5. So we're pretty much the same with our kind of movies that we're recommending here. But throwing back to Oh Brothers, Where Art Thou, and the subject that we're going to have about this podcast is we're going to be getting into elements of film. So usually we talk about films that are of note, you know, the 7.5s and higher usually. I mean,
we try.
Yeah, we try to. I mean, maybe our 7's and up. You know, it's where we try to kind of hold our scales at and our own opinions, respectively. But, you know, Neil being a junior colorist, we all went to film school, Kyle as well. Kyle's a working DP as well. You know, I just watch nice films. I work in marketing, so I'm not really in the industry anymore, but I certainly have my own tastes. But
Don't sell yourself short,
yeah,
Cooper.
Yeah,
come on.
Yeah.
But, you're an excellent script writer.
That's true, too. I'm an excellent writer. so many times that we forget that what makes a film great is elements of film. So that's what this aspect of this film is going to be about. Well, not this film, but this episode is going to be about is we're going to be
looking
at...
This could be a film.
This could... Yeah. we could put it something else. But
it's like on YouTube.
Kind of visuals. Yeah, it's true. It's on YouTube.
There's a video.
There's a JPEG that's... it's a film of some sorts. But, you know, by and large, it's going to be Neil talking about color correction because you have a lot more experience with it.
We'll keep it a conversation.
We'll keep it a conversation for sure. But we're going to discuss the element that is color correction. And... how that's changed in the industry, what the real technicals are about it, how it's evolved.
Let's keep this
impact.
Let's keep this kind of as a 101,
mm-hmm.
and more of like maybe just like philosophy behind color.
Okay.
In the industry sense of what does that mean? Like what does color?
Yeah. And something
that's what is color correction? What is color grading?
Yeah.
I've never heard those terms, or maybe you have heard those terms. And you didn't know that they were actually different,
mm-hmm.
that they don't mean the same thing. Or maybe you're starting to do color right now, and maybe there's insights that you're hoping I have.
I think you do. I mean, you've come a really long way, a really, really long way. And I'd have to say a pretty short period of time, because people don't know, but Neil goes hard in the paint. Like...
Cooper, what does hard in the paint mean?
No,
I'm kidding.
Hard in the paint means that you just go hard in the paint. You know it when you see it. And my friend, I have seen it inside of you. Take it away. Talk about some color and like what your perspectives have been. How have you seen it evolve? What's your personal kind of takeaway?
So maybe what's a good place to start? Maybe it's a good place to start would be...
Start at the beginning.
Maybe more of, okay, so what is color grading? Because it's kind of, you know, it's actually something that you don't get an Academy Award for.
No.
There's no...
Surprisingly not.
Yeah, it's not something... It's not in the spotlight. It's not... It's something that I didn't even learn about in film school.
Until the very end.
And it was...
The last semester.
and it was kind of by... Like, it was not even by, like, coursework. It was just kind of by accident more than anything. Like...
Kismet, some would say.
Yeah. So all color grading is if we look at it maybe back in the film time, like film days, mm-hmm. it is adding a look or correcting inconsistencies in your project. So at the basic level,
mm-hmm.
color correction is mainly balancing and fixing footage. So if you shot 10 days worth of footage, you're editing it together, and they're completely different, you know, sets and settings, but in the movie it's supposed to be
one consistent thing.
If you don't have things that look the same, it's gonna give away everything. It's your cuts, it'll completely take you out of the movie. Mm-hmm. And so at the most basic level, color correction is to make everything consistent.
Right. And then I'd also say, for people who, to make it a little bit more approachable, I think the best color correction, and I mean, this is by a long shot, it's nowhere near color correction, but the most color correction people are most familiar with, sadly, is Instagram.
Yeah.
No, that you know, is, when people
I would
are
going say that's color grading.
That'd say, yeah, that is color grading for sure. Because you're not bringing.
I mean, we don't need to split hairs because it's but, very similar. But
well, I think that's where, because not a lot of people know film, but certainly people know how to change the brightness on their
Instagram,
on Instagram, or on just personal on the, photos, yeah, or exactly. iPhoto, or you know those basic photo editors. So it's, I mean, it's pretty much that, but for film on a much deeper level,
it's a lot more complicated.
Because let people know what is it that you usually get. In like, what is it that you are doing post-production work for? Because we usually, when people get any kind of film, how does it arrive?
Okay, so maybe this is a good point to let's do a little history lesson. Okay. And again, we were talking about how we're very fortunate that we live in a digital world.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, it was simpler back with film because the science was baked into the film.
Right.
So what I mean by that is, you go out, you shoot a film. Okay, the cinematographer and director's done. They're passing it on. And when it gets to a colorist, they can use the same process. The way they ingest it is almost the same every time.
Mm-hmm.
They use a telecine. It comes out as a certain log, could say, or some sort of flatness to apply a look. And they can just do that forever, because everyone shot on film. There were no different, there was different film stocks, but that just kind of, it was just different baked in images.
Right.
Well, now that we're done with that, now that we've gone digital, think of it like codecs. And, right. Maybe.
What is a codec as well?
Yeah.
I mean, kind of like how there's a JPEG and there's a GIF and there's a, there's different file formats for pictures. You know, that whole different amounts of information.
Yeah, well, different companies. Codecs. Yeah, different companies have to create file types, and they get to maybe a similar result through a different means.
Right.
And these codecs can't always talk to each other.
Yeah, and that's actually a big problem in the industry. And the fact that you have a Panasonic that uses AVC HD, then you have a Canon that uses .movs, then you have Arri Alexa, even that, like you said, that even though it's a raw image. Raw means that it's a lot of editable latitudes, or it's a lot of information for people to use in. You know, you say that it's more punchy in the blues, and even not all raw is created equal. It's very different based on sensor types and
raw essentially is just not applying any sort of compression. There's always a little bit of compression, but there's not applying any sort of baked in imagery to a file. Because if you shoot something with your still camera,
right?
The sensor, if we get down to the particle level, the sensor is like,
excellent. Let's do that.
Is, you know, just counting the photons. Like, think of them like glasses of water. When the water fills up a certain high for as many photons that enter it, and there's just a bunch of these glasses that are in the sensor, and that's essentially all it is. It's all just black and white for the camera, because it doesn't know anything.
What is it that makes... I didn't know that. What makes it into color, then? It's a different part of the sensor?
It's just filters. It's just these... It's basically like gels over the photons that... not over the photons, but over the glasses that weed out certain color. So it'll either let something through or it'll not. It's kind of the same...
Okay.
Same idea.
I had no idea that's how that worked.
Yeah.
I thought it was completely...
But to the camera, it's just black and white.
Right.
But maybe, so it has a red glass that it says, oh, this is for red photons. How many photons are in this?
Mm-hmm.
So now it knows how red it is. Cool. You know, that's basically how that works.
If I remember right, there's one red sensor, a blue sensor, and then two green. Right? Usually there's more green sensors in most film.
Yeah, it's like red, green, blue, green, red, green, blue, green. It goes back and forth like that. And that's, from my understanding, is mainly because green holds most of the luminance Well, okay. Most of the brightness, the black and white color, or I can't say color, black and white.
I can understand that, because a lot of times when you see shadow, like the most often that a shadow is colored is usually a green,
right,
or a tint of a green.
Mm-hmm.
So getting out of cameras, going into not too many technicalities, but like within software, is like, what happens to the color? Like, where do you, I don't know, where do you kind of go in the next process? Let's just say you've got the film, it's flat, and then you go into what?
Well, okay, so before we get to that, just to explain what we were starting with is, so we had the film,
mm-hmm.
which it's like almost a one-size-fit-all process where it's like, okay, use whatever right. stock you want. I'm going to ingest this the same way using a telecine because it's a negative film. It's okay. they're the same. Like, they're all the same.
Right.
It's just a negative film. I process it. Now I got it. I can color it.
Mm-hmm.
Well, with digital, because we have different manufacturers, we have different cameras, different ways of getting these sensors that I just described,
mm-hmm.
How they can achieve some sort of replication of reality.
Yeah.
It gets complicated of how can you, if you put two cameras up next to each other, they're not going to look the same.
Right.
Not only that, they're going to have different levels of flatness.
Right.
And by flatness, of what we normally call like a log gamma is just
how dark are the darks and how bright are the brights.
Kinda. I mean,
that's how I come at it. I mean,
so if you look at an image and it looks like real life,
mm-hmm.
we can call that a linear gamma.
Okay.
I won't get too technical. I shouldn't really be using the term linear. But let's think of it like that, where it's a straight line.
Right.
Zero
is black.
Zero is black. 100 is white. 50 is middle gray.
Yeah.
Or, you know, like that. Yeah, that's just what it looks like.
Photoshop knows exactly what you're talking
okay.
about.
Okay. So a log image isn't a straight line. It's a logarithmic curve.
Okay.
So that's what the log means. And all that does is instead of one being one, like if you up a photon by one,
okay.
It doesn't go up by one. Instead, it uses basically f-stops because it's logarithmic.
Okay.
So it's like exponential. So it's only going to go up a certain level when you double the amount of light.
Oh.
So everything gets crushed down to the middle and it looks very gray.
Okay.
It looks like it has very little color.
But that's where the most information is for the image.
It's a math process of, okay, we see that this white is supposed to be
mm-hmm.
this many photon. It's like this bright, but to save, we want to get as much information as possible. We only have as many bits as we have.
Right.
We're gonna compress it down, everything down to this level, logarithmically, and then later in the stage, we'll reverse that math.
Okay.
We'll give you the equation to reverse that math. And now you have everything. So it's a way for like manufacturers to preserve detail
mm-hmm.
in the shadows and in the highlights.
Yeah, that reminds me in graphic design with Illustrator, there's something called a vector file.
Mm-hmm.
And essentially that isn't information by pixels. It's information based off an equation.
Math, yeah.
Yeah, mathematical. It's where you can make it, you know, the size of a letterhead, or you can blow it up to the size of a billboard, you know, and it would maintain all of its color as well as its sharpness and, you know, full resolution of the whole image. So
I'd almost say that's kind of, and I won't say it's exact, but that's kind of an equivalent of raw.
Yeah. Yeah.
And
that's
not raw.
That's how I was more so kind of trying to connect those two.
Yeah, exactly.
Cause
that's a good,
I'm trying to make it a little bit more approachable, because a lot of times people hear color correction and they think it's like this, you know, it just has a lot of different like lexicon associated with it, but
yeah,
really it's just like it's highlights, shadows, and the things that appear in the middle. So it's like,
yeah,
you have to squint your eyes. We're talking about highlights, and it's like your pupils are nice and big.
Yeah, highlights, bright.
Yeah,
yeah. No, I mean, yeah, exactly.
Most people understand brightness.
Yeah, we'll come full circle and explain. I'm getting a little bit into the details, but
Good. Full
circle, and it'll probably make more sense when you look at it from a top down view of, you know, you don't need to know how everything happens.
Mm-hmm.
But if you know why, you know, you could
right.
kind of figure everything else out.
And then people who are listening right now, because a lot of people sometimes will maybe consider color correction a snooze fest when you talk about the mathematics of it, but I think most people get into a snooze fest when you talk about mathematics of anything. But they don't realize that it's this level of math that brings about an emotional reaction within film. Or
yeah.
a novel reaction within film, just how we talked about Oh Brother, Where Art Thou. There's an unforgettable color to it, and it's not possible without color science.
Mm-hmm.
And
color science goes beyond color correction.
Yeah.
Color science is just a big... That's cinematographers, mm-hmm. I mean, direct... Literally, down the line...
It's a whole... From beginning to end, it's a whole thought process, from
right.
what I understand.
Regardless if people are thinking about it, it's been thought about for them. Just how Kodak did that with film back in the day.
Right.
It was thought about, they baked it into the film.
Right.
You don't need to worry about it, just shoot something. We've got it done for you.
Mm-hmm.
So now today, it's not quite that. Now, I mean, we have things baked into the camera. It's like, hey, we thought about it for you. We're going to give you the best information in the camera we can. But you kind of need to know what's happening on the backstage to get that information out of it.
Right.
That's kind of, I think, what a lot of like digital intermediary, like color mm-hmm. Colorists do,
right.
is they're almost like this jockey
mm-hmm.
of... able to get, they're kind of the expert color scientist.
Okay.
As well as being an artist, where they...
It's a little hybrid position in a way.
That's a lot of post, I think, as like in post-production, that's kind of the, maybe not color scientist, but it's a very, like post in general, I think is very technical,
mm-hmm.
but at the end of the day, it's supposed to be artistic.
Yeah.
So yeah, it's kind of a left and right brain thing simultaneously.
That's very you. I think
it's very interesting.
Yeah, I like it. And as far as color correction goes, because you know it's hard to look at a movie, because I remember one time I was watching Silver Linings Playbook
mm-hmm.
with a lady, and
was that
and
who was that you were just
that was a buddy Bill Burr. but I remember I was watching it and I was just pointing out to her like the golds that are in it and like how warm the interior of the house is, and how the house is this place of love and warmth, and how it's the warmest shots are usually within love, and then the reality is like very white, kind of pale when like they're out jogging or something like that, but how much it plays with color.
Yeah.
And she never noticed it, and she was like, I never realized.
She might
this.
Not have noticed it, but she felt it.
Exactly. It's kind of like it's exactly that. It's like a score in a film. It's like you can just experience it, or you can note that it's there and experience it. Because it's one kind of thing that sort of, the more and more you know about films, the more things you can get hung up on, because you pay attention a little bit more to the details and so on and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, I think you can appreciate them at a deeper level.
Of course.
And,
yeah.
I mean, I guess I'll stick to Silver Linings Playbook, that, you know, it allows you to... experience a film in a deeper level, allows you to connect to the emotions in a deeper level, and it allows you to connect themes as well within characters. I know one commonality that could be very approachable for people is Breaking Bad.
Yeah.
The entire time, Breaking Bad always played with color, from garments that people wore to the actual color for location, to the color of, you know, what Walter White was feeling, to
yeah,
you know,
like color,
yeah, entirely isn't where they were.
Color grading, or like adding a color palette to a film, while a big part of that is color grading,
mm-hmm.
probably the biggest part of it is set design
mm-hmm.
and wardrobe.
Yeah.
And, you know,
those colors have to pop.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, the colors generally have to be there to begin with
mm-hmm.
before you're not just going to add maybe a color that didn't exist necessarily.
Right.
But yeah, that's like, I think that is what separates probably professional. I mean, there's a lot of things that separate professional and amateur,
right.
but kind of, I feel like one of the last stages is
mm-hmm.
a color palette in pre-production.
Yeah.
Getting an actual color palette on set live.
And then I guess another approachable one, what I would say the two most, you say Breaking Bad, then I would say The Sixth Sense, and then also The Matrix.
Yeah.
I feel like are things that people can connect with and understand that when we're talking about color and how it evokes certain responses, that those colors, like you said, has to exist within the scene, but then it's the color correctionist's job to say, okay, but how much is it going to be notable? And the director has to think about that. And the cinematographer has to think about that. What kind of camera are they going to use? Okay, we're going to use this kind of camera because it handles this kind of like, let's say shadows or something like that. Or it's really good at pulling this out. Is it going to be a horror
film? It's a team effort.
For sure, for sure. You know, and it's when a the very colorist unforeseen is, effort yeah. that you know, definitely goes unnoticed. But once you do notice it, it is like, I feel like it just makes a film so much more gratifying on a whole nother level. We were just watching Ex Machina, and the entire time, like, I mean,
it's beautiful.
It's beautiful film. It's an absolutely beautiful,
the color is great,
and breathtaking movie. And I think color is one of the, I think sound and color, I mean, duh, in film is one of the reasons that you need to go to the movies. Because when there is good sound and there is good color, you can truly see it at the movie theater for that reason. And I think when we saw Ex Machina, even the movie theater, I mean, just like, the colors were just like bleeding off the screen.
Yeah.
And when you get to experience that, it's a whole nother level of appreciation. And like you said, it's what separates the amateurs from the pros that really have dotted their I's and crossed their T's. And it makes something just exist and come together on a whole nother level that it's unmistakable. And,
oh, yeah.
And it's how, if you think about The Matrix, you think about the tinted greens, you think about the deep dark blacks, you think about the contrast.
Mm-hmm.
When you think about I'm trying to come up with who's the director who was gonna direct The Hobbit, but then it became Peter Jackson anyway. He's that horror director, did Pan's Labyrinth. He has a Spanish name.
Guillermo del Toro.
He has a very specific color palette. And when you're talking about the auteur sense of a lot of directors, it's very common that they stick with a certain color palette. Another excellent example, which is a director that I'm going to forget the name of. I know movies, but I don't know names of directors. He went to UTA. The University of Arlington.
Yeah.
I'm blanking out. Life Aquatic.
Wes Anderson.
Wes Anderson is incredibly notable.
I didn't know he went to UTA, actually.
Yeah, I know.
I mean, I knew he was local. Texas, I didn't know he went to UTA,
why, like,
though.
Bottle Cap was, you know, a Texas film.
Interesting, okay.
That's actually like one of like UTA's like, look at us. And then RoboCop went to UNT. The guy who played RoboCop.
Oh.
Pete Weller. Yeah. Texas.
So did Dr. Phil.
Oh, yeah, that's right. Ugh.
He's like our main.
Yeah.
Mm.
Anywho. with Wes Anderson, there's an unmistakable, playful, and fun color palette. When you look at the last movie that he did with the hotel, what's the name of that one?
Budapest.
Grand Budapest Grand Hotel.
Yep.
That has an unmistakable Wes Anderson look. And I think that's an excellent director that his auteur sense is seen clearly with his framing, with his style of acting, but also with his color that he chooses.
Yeah, his
and
color
he
palettes.
Hits it on every single level.
Mm-hmm.
And if you took away the element of color, because it is such an integral part of his film style, it would not be a Wes Anderson film anymore.
No, it wouldn't.
And so that's what we're talking about, is that it's a pivotal point if you allow it to breathe. If you give color its ability to reach its potential, it creates an unmistakable film. All the way from The Godfather to modern films, like we just said with the Grand Budapest Hotel, that color has always been something that evokes emotion.
It's color honestly that makes us one react. Of, yeah, it's one on of the most level. Important parts of a film that we never think about.
Exactly.
It's
definitely a subconscious. It's probably have to say it's the most subconscious.
Unless it's in your face or something, but most of the time it's not.
Yeah, pretty rarely.
Yeah, yeah. But so, like, talking about seeing something at a movie theater, spot on, and I don't know if you knew why exactly you're spot on. I'm sure a lot of people don't know this, but you actually get more colors at a movie theater.
Oh yeah, it's color true projectors and.
Well, it actually has more colors available to it. It's a larger range of colors it can use.
Probably because of the file that they also use the projectors to project off of, and like the screen as well.
Well, it has to do with something called color spaces.
Tell us about color spaces, Neil.
So color space is just if we were able to map all visible color that we can see on a two-dimensional graph. So color is in 3D. Like if you ever actually graph this, it's a 3D. You got red, you got green, you got blue. You mix those together and you can get any kind of color you want.
Right.
that's using additive coloring, like right. if you yeah
within the digital realm space.
Sure. Yeah. Right. So if you were to put that on a 2D graph, if you were to draw a triangle in that graph representing red, green, and blue, you have a triangle, and it's always going to be a triangle,
right?
Because those are the three colors you can use.
Mm-hmm.
The color space is where those, the shape of the triangle, basically.
Okay.
How big, the angle of it, like where it rests. That is a color space.
So I'm seeing like red with like a gradation of all the different levels of red, from the deepest, darkest red to the lightest of reds, and how it intermixes with all the others.
Yeah, so
it's kind of like a gradation that you would see with any kind of like mix of colors.
Yeah, so like if you would actually look up this graph, it's the center of it is white,
mm-hmm.
and then the very outside edges are the most saturated parts of that color.
Okay, of RGB.
Yes.
Okay.
It looks kind of like a triangle, but it doesn't have sharp edges necessarily, like a triangle.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of looks like a bow, like a bow and arrow, like a bow.
Okay.
Very elongated, though.
Hmm.
But yeah, so the center of it is white. And so the triangle, you know, goes out to the more saturated ends. But yeah, so a movie theater has a much larger triangle than your TV does.
Yeah.
So even, you know, you can torrent a movie that just came out and watch it on your TV because you want to save some money by not going to the theater. But you actually literally are missing out.
Well, this is a great example that people, a great example of color space is if you look into the shadows of your film and you see that there's those little squares that are happening and you're getting what are known as artifacts, that it's not a true deep black or it's not a true proper color. Your screen kind of tries to guess and gives you those artifacts to make that color space filled with something. But when you're dealing with a very small file, from my understanding, I'm pretty...
Sure.
Pretty small-minded as far as like, you know, file spaces and color spaces compared to your experience, that you get less. I mean, like you said, that triangle is very shrunken, and then you put it on a monitor that's not completely and perfectly calibrated to play that certain type of codec, whereas movie theater is in harmony on all levels, and it's made to be in harmony, and it's the best way to experience it for sure.
Yeah, so a colorist job has a lot to do with this, what we're talking about right now, because they obviously have to think of all these things, and if you have a movie that's going to be shown in theaters, like wide release, and then you're like, oh, they're going to go to Blu-ray, right. They're going to go to DVD,
right?
Well, they're going to have to do two passes now on color, one that uses the movie theater color space, and one that uses your TV color space.
Okay.
Otherwise, if you threw on the movie color space onto the TV, it's going to be out of whack.
Yeah.
It'll look...
Because it'll try to be colors that it can't even project.
Exactly.
Hmm.
Exactly. And so it's going to clip things. I think what it actually do, it'll look very saturated.
Okay.
Was it the other way around? I can't remember now. But if you do the vice versa, if you send something to theater and it's was designed for
a TV.
It's gonna look messed up as well.
Yeah.
In
your opinion, as far as color correction goes, you know, apart from Over the Roar, though, obviously you recommended that. What would be two other films that you would say that you should, you know, rewatch, and maybe either rewatch if you've already seen it, or something that you should notice the color in?
Something that you would definitely notice the color in is Michael Bay.
Mm.
I'm not gonna say it's good.
Okay.
But because I don't particularly care for Michael Bay films, but his color is unmistakable. If you see a still frame of a Michael Bay film, you know immediately this is a Michael Bay film, even if you've never seen the movie before.
That's true. And because, I'll say, just to interrupt you, you're probably forgetting your own film that you loved, if you weren't going to say it or not, was Mad Max.
Yeah.
You love Mad Max in a big level. I mean, you walked out of there and you're like, my God, that was so much style. It was ridiculous.
Oh, yeah. I mean, in for the same way, it was literally kind of what Michael Bay does.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe a little bit. It was more stylized than Michael Bay, even in a grittier way, though.
Right.
Well, Michael Bay is very much a glitz glamour kind of color. Very look. Smooth. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But it's heavily orange on the skin tones,
mm-hmm.
and then heavily teal and blue for everything else.
Yeah, and that's when, you know, and as far as color spaces go, it's kind of a common trend that orange and teal is used, and definitely overused.
I just want to warn you of using that term color spaces the way you're using it.
Okay,
don't confuse. Don't use that term.
Color styles.
Sure. Okay.
It's color styles. I didn't even realize I said color spaces. My apologies.
Yeah, let's not get people confused.
So, what would be your second recommendation while we have about a minute left here?
Drive. I think Drive is a good film.
Dude, that's an excellent film.
So Drive was colored by an excellent colorist named Tom Poole. He'd done a couple films before that, I think, but Drive was the big one that he started his career, I think, where people gave recognition.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a very stylized film, but it's like a subtle stylized.
Yeah, it's very
it's orange and teal. It's mm-hmm. the classic orange and teal, but it's
pink and...
Well, it's just subtle in comparison. It's not like in your face, saturated like Michael Bay.
Yeah, and they definitely... And talking, more so reflecting back on how we talked about the scene placement, and that there are so many scenes to where... Ryan Gosling's character will have a completely blue background,
mm-hmm.
whereas behind the female character, I forgot her name,
I can't remember either.
Hers was just like, it was red and pinks, and so like that character has that color bonded to them for the rest of the film, and that follows them wherever they go,
mm-hmm.
and you know, and that's a part of the work of the set designer and the director to be that mindful, and the cinematographer to film it in different ways, and I mean, definitely when you're watching film, try to pick up the colors a little bit more, see what they're trying to say, like, because it's so often that there's reason that, you know, logos are certain colors. They capture our attention. They make us feel certain ways.
Yeah.
They know that it's going to give us a certain attitude. So I'd say...
Just a kind of a recap in case we mm-hmm. went off the deep end a little bit on color correction, but just a quick recap is it's basically just a colorist job to wade through the bog of confusion in color science. And
one man stands alone.
They're almost, in a way, they're the expert on color. I mean, they are the expert on color.
Mm-hmm, for sure.
And so they're technically making this film sound, and it's going to work, while also artistically adding value to it by accenting certain things or bringing attention to a part in the scene. Or taking attention away from something.
Mm-hmm.
That's what a colorist to me is.
That's a great way to wrap everything up.
Okay, great.
Well, if you guys have any questions about coloring, for sure, comment. I'll make sure that Neil gets those questions and he can answer them, or I'll try to answer them best that I can. But this was us just looking at elements of film. I'm sure later on we'll explore things like editing, sound, cinematography, framing, all the elements that you could imagine and maybe haven't ever imagined that are a part of cinema today. So I've been Cooper Carr. Thank you so much for listening.
Thanks, guys. It's Neil Anderson.
All right, guys. See you on the next one.